Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 3rd of June, these are our main stories. Claudia Sheinbaum has been elected as Mexico's first woman president in a landslide win. Nigeria's power grid has been shut down because of a nationwide strike over the minimum wage. And scientists in Britain make a potential breakthrough in testing for breast cancer. Also in this podcast, we hear from a brave Russian librarian speaking truth to power.
The situation in our country now is similar with the situation in 1984. Total control from the state and total control from the security structure.
And reports suggest that controversial fast food fashion firm Shein is about to float on the London Stock Exchange for what could be one of the biggest share sales in history. We start in Mexico City with what many people are seeing as a significant moment. A few hours ago, the electoral authorities confirmed that Mexico would have its first female president. She's Claudia Sheinbaum, a climate scientist and the former mayor of Mexico City, and she won a landslide victory in Sunday's election. This report from our Mexico correspondent, Will Grant.
Amigas, amigos. Muchas gracias por esperarnos.
As Claudia Sheinbaum stepped onto the stage at her victory party, she marked a genuine moment of history in Mexico.
Sí, se pudo.
In a country where women only got the vote in the 1950s, she becomes the first woman to break centuries of male domination over the presidency. Her win echoed down generations of Mexican women, she said.
Que por primera vez en 200 años.
For the first time in 200 years, women have reached the presidency, she told her jubilant supporters in the capital's main plaza, the Zócalo. Those who turned out to support her were overjoyed.
It's historic, completely. It's for the women who are no longer with us and those who are still fighting, not just in the political arena, but wherever women are concerned.
To see someone who comes from the grassroots struggle make it to the presidency, it's so emotional. For me, it's marvellous.
In a country with such entrenched machismo, what Claudia Sheinbaum has achieved here is no small feat. Other women have tried and failed, including her closest rival in this vote, Xochitl Galvez. But her offer of continuity, of extending the governing party's social policies, which have pulled millions from poverty, has proved hugely popular with the electorate.
Her critics, however, are disheartened. At a predominantly opposition-led neighbourhood of the city, voters said her mentor, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is a populist and an authoritarian, and that Ms. Sheinbaum will govern as his mere puppet, something she roundly denies. This election has been historic for all the wrong reasons, too. It's been Mexico's most violent campaign in living memory, with dozens of candidates threatened and murdered. Even on polling day itself, there were incidents of violence, with two people shot and one of them killed in the state of Puebla. After the incident, the head of the electoral body at the polling station announced that the vote had been suspended in the municipality, to consternation from those waiting outside to cast their ballots. Another group of Mexicans excluded from the democratic process by the drug cartels. Claudia Sheinbaum supporters have chanted Presidenta, meaning woman president, at her throughout the campaign. Now, though, it's true. Yet most voters want the president-elect to prioritise tackling the drug cartels over all other issues in her in-tray. Claudia Sheinbaum inherits a nation mired in violence. Her challenge now will be to succeed where so many men before her have failed.
Mexico is a nation of unenviable contrast when it comes to women's rights. On the one hand, it was one of the first countries to have women make up half of all members of Congress. But at the same time, violence against women is a huge problem. Almost 4,000 women were killed there last year, many of them specifically targeted because of their gender. The BBC's Lourdes Heredia was born in Mexico. She says this is a landmark moment in her country's history.
When I grew up, being a female president was nothing you could dream of. It just seemed so impossible. I remember my grandmother, when I was doing a documentary for the BBC about the macho culture, she literally told me, and at that time I didn't have any kids, she said, if a woman doesn't have a kid, even if she has a very important job, it's not worth her living. Meaning, women are there to be a baby machine, otherwise you're not worth being in this world. And that was my grandmother defending that in my family there was no macho culture. I mean, so imagine how big it is that we have the first female president in Mexico. It's a big deal.
That was Lourdes Heredia. A nationwide strike over a minimum wage is causing chaos in Nigeria's public sector. The national electricity grid has been shut down, causing blackouts across the country. And passengers have been left stranded outside Nigeria's largest airport. Our correspondent Azizat Ola Olua is at the airport in Lagos, and she told me what was happening there.
The disruption is quite huge. The two main gates leading to the local terminal of the airport have been cordoned off by workers. In fact, they locked the gates, put down chairs, and they are sitting in front of it to ensure that no vehicle passenger gets access to the domestic terminals.
So quite a lot of disruption there. What about the rest of the country? We're hearing that there are quite widespread blackouts caused by problems with the electricity grid.
Absolutely. The national grid has been shut down by electricity workers, and so there's total blackout across many parts of the country. Judiciary workers are also observing the strike. Courts have been shut. Workers are there present, but they're just sitting doing nothing. So it's not just one sector that is affected. The main purpose of the nationwide strike is to force the hand of the government to the negotiation table so they listen to the demands of labor unions. And they are asking for at least $300, but the government is saying that it can only afford one-ninth of that.
It sounds to me as if this strike, we've had a number of strikes over the last year, this one seems to be more effective. Why is that, do you think?
It's more effective because many unions are all on the same page this time around. So at least 14 union associations in Nigeria of workers have all agreed, you know, to observe this indefinite strike, because at the end of the day, if the new national minimum wage is affected, all of them will be affected by it. So that's why they've come together this time around.
Now, there is a vast difference between what the unions want and what the government says it is prepared to give. What chance is there of some kind of negotiation?
Well, there are chances of negotiation because just yesterday evening, the leadership of the National Assembly and some state governors actually called leaders of the labor unions to an emergency meeting, asking them to shelve the strike action for today. But at the end of the day, it ended in a deadlock. So it means that the government officials understand the importance of this strike and they know what it's going to do to the economy, which is already affected. So there is a possibility that it may be called off. We don't know yet, but this is a resounding strike action on the first day, which has affected many sectors across the country. And workers believe that they are going to hear something from the government asking their leaders to get back to the negotiation table. But the big question is, will the government agree to the demands of labor? Many doubt that. But will both parties agree on another figure, maybe meet at the middle, something realistic? That is what many people want to see.
That was Azizat Ola Olua. Scientists in Britain have made a breakthrough in testing for breast cancer, which they say could eventually prove a major lifesaver. They've pioneered a predictive blood test which can detect very small amounts of cancerous DNA in the blood, and that allows them to forecast the return of the disease 3 years before any tumours show up on scans. Dr. Isaac Garcia Morillas is lead author of the study for the Institute of Cancer Research in London. He spoke to Paul Henley from Chicago, where he's presenting the results of his work.
It's about detecting between 1 in 3 cancer molecules mixed with 1 million normal molecules.
And in your research, were you able to identify every patient in the trial who later went on to have a relapse of the disease?
Yeah, correct. We had 11 women that relapsed during follow-up, and we identified all of them with a lead time of a clinical relapse of 15 months. That's the median lead time. The longest lead time that we identified was 41 months. So the lead time is how early can you detect that somebody is going to relapse before they do that clinically.
And tell me why early detection is so important in this type of cancer treatment.
The sooner you pick up cancer, the more chances you have of treating that cancer earlier. The earlier you treat that cancer, the more chances you have of that particular patient responding to treatment.
This is a big breakthrough, isn't it? Because of the sheer numbers of women who are diagnosed every year with breast cancer. I think well over 2 million women worldwide.
Yeah, that is correct. This is a very exciting breakthrough because what we have in here is a test that offers a much higher sensitivity, which will allow us to find more women before they relapse.
Is there something about this form of cancer in particular that makes it more prone to return? We're talking about a test that predicts the return of the disease. Is that prevalent in this type?
Yeah, depending on the breast cancer that you have, some of them are more aggressive and come back earlier, and some of them are a slightly bit more indolent and take more years to come back. Our test allows us to identify which patients are going to relapse irrespectively of the breast cancer they have.
That was the cancer specialist, Dr. Isa Garcia-Murillas. In recent years, particularly since Brexit, the once mighty London Stock Exchange has lost out to other financial centres like New York, Paris or Frankfurt. But now London could be about to have its largest ever launch. The fashion firm Shein is preparing to sell shares in a public offering worth more than $60 billion. The business was founded in China but is now based in Singapore. Our correspondent David Willis tells me more about it.
It is the world's largest fashion retailer, and it offers a wide range of cheap clothes, backed by this big social media campaign, which it's mounted across various platforms. It's seen profits of $2 billion in 2023 alone. It currently operates in more than 150 countries, boasts 150 million global users. And the report suggests that Shein is preparing to float on the London Stock Exchange. It's been valued at about £50 billion, that's $66 billion. So the flotation, if it does go ahead, could be the largest in the history of the London Stock Exchange.
So it would be very good for the London Stock Exchange at a time when other flotations are moving elsewhere. And yet this company, Shein, is controversial, isn't it?
It is. It relies on thousands of third-party suppliers as well as contract manufacturers in China and can turn around a new item in just a matter of weeks, which is not something that many of its competitors can claim. But it's faced allegations that Uyghur forced labour has been used to make some of the products that it sells. And indeed, last month, a report suggested that workers for some of Shein's suppliers were working as much as 75 hours a week. That despite promises that the company has made in the past that it would improve its working conditions. Indeed, the Swiss advocacy group Public Eye found that staff across six sites in the Chinese manufacturing hub of Guangzhou were working excessive overtime. Shein had initially been looking to list on the New York Stock Exchange. That was before regulatory hurdles got in the way. But you're absolutely right. An IPO of this size on the London Stock Exchange would be a coup for that exchange, which has been losing listings to its New York rivals, New York Stock Exchange and Nasdaq, of course.
David Willis. Since its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russia has intensified its crackdown on dissent. A string of repressive laws has been adopted to silence criticism of the war and of the Kremlin. But as our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports from the city of Ivanovo, a famous novel which was published 75 years ago is giving some Russians a way to vent their concern at the direction their country's taken.
Drive 4 hours from Moscow to Ivanovo, and you will discover a most remarkable place, the tiny library. And hanging outside is a portrait of George Orwell. Librarian Alexandra Karasiva shows me around the George Orwell Library. It was set up after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine as an antidote to propaganda and a reminder of the dangers of totalitarianism. There are books here about Stalin's terror and the crimes of communism, and multiple copies of Orwell's 1984. Alexandra explains why.
The situation in our country now is similar with the situation in 1984. Total control from the state and total control from the security structures.
One other similarity, the manipulation of reality. On state TV here, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is presented as an act of self-defense, occupation as liberation, reality inverted. Just as in 1984, citizens are told that war is peace and ignorance is strength. Alexandra believes that in such an environment, the library fulfills a vital function.
These books show our readers that the power of autocratic regimes is not forever, that every system has its weak points.
These books are not banned in Russia, but the subject matter is sensitive. Honest discussion of Russia's past or present can bring problems. And problems they have. The local businessman who was funding the project has fled abroad and is wanted by police. And there's another issue. The library doesn't have many visitors. A dystopian future. Few in Ivanovo seem worried. In the town centre, it's a big band, not Big Brother, that's drawing a crowd. People are dancing in the sunshine to classic Soviet melodies. Some here embrace the direction in which Russia's moving. They're making progress, says a young lady called Natalia. As Putin says, for Russia, this is a new stage. But what about Russia's war in Ukraine? I don't watch anything about that now, Nina says. It's just too upsetting. Back at the George Orwell Library, Alexandra breaks some news to the handful of visitors. The building's been put up for sale. The library has to move out. Immediately, one woman offers use of her van to help move to temporary premises. Other people suggest ideas on how to raise money. This is civil society in action, admittedly on a tiny scale and with no guarantee of success. But they're not giving up. Not yet.
Steve Rosenberg. Still to come on the Global News Podcast. If you're fishing for treasure, is $100,000 as good as it gets?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest finds in history, actually, cash value-wise.
Stay with us for the full story of the two magnet fishers from New York.
The explanation from the BBC World Service.
What's actually going on here? Let's analyse it.
Making sense of the big stories.
As an economics reporter, what do you think the economic impact is?
Oh, it's massive.
And giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world.
We'll look at our subject from several different angles to connect dots with the geopolitics.
And explain the trends behind the fast-changing media landscape.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
We've just had the first criminal trial of a former president in the United States. And starting just as we're recording this podcast, America brings us the first criminal trial of a president's child. For Joe Biden, it is uncomfortable timing as his son Hunter appears in court just months before the November election. Hank Scheinkoff is a political consultant and former member of Bill Clinton's media team.
In a close election, people that are not liking Joe Biden are not going to like Hunter Biden. But you can't equate the president's son to the former president of the United States. You know, in American politics, November is about 300 years away from now, because in the United States, anything can happen and usually does during an election cycle. Where Trump's popularity is very strong, where there are enough Make America Great, again, MAGA people, Trump's numbers will continue to rise. Their hatred for Joe Biden will increase exponentially, as will their disdain for Hunter Biden. But it's going to be hard to make the president's son into a national issue.
Justin Webb heard more from our North America correspondent, Tom Bateman.
This trial dates back to events in late 2018 when Hunter Biden went into a gun store here in Wilmington, Delaware, the family hometown, and purchased a 38 caliber revolver. Now, critically, he filled in a form and also gave a record to the gun shop. Now, he ticked the box to say he was not an unlawful drug user, and he possessed this handgun for the next 11 days. That started a chain of events which have culminated to these indictments being brought late last year, in which he is accused of lying on those forms because, so say the prosecution, he was knowingly a drug addict at the time and in their view had been using drugs. He denies this, although he, by his own admission, has battled with addiction to both drugs and alcohol. What his defence says, he wouldn't have defined himself at that time as addicted to drugs and therefore he wasn't lying on the forms. But what this trial will do inevitably is to sort of unleash in graphic detail elements of Hunter Biden's private life, which is going to be a very challenging time, obviously, for the Biden family.
And it's not the only trial he faces.
That's right. In California, he faces later this year a series of charges over allegations of tax evasion.
And obviously, politically, a real desire on the part of some Republicans to link the allegations about him to Joe Biden. They want Joe Biden to be involved as much as they can involve him in the lifestyle that you've described of Hunter Biden, and the simple fact that Hunter Biden made his money peddling influence, and that's something they say he could not have done without the president.
Absolutely, and that's been a very long-running claim of Republicans, not least in the House of Representatives, who began an impeachment inquiry into the president, which is now midway through a process in the House. More than that, in this particular case, Republicans are trying to say that he received preferential treatment by the Department of Justice, something that the administration completely rejects. But conversely, Hunter Biden's own lawyer has tried to claim that the prosecution was, in their words, vindictive and selective, because the special counsel here, that appointment earlier on was by Donald Trump. So both sides are trying to draw out the allegations that this is all political, both in terms of the way he's being prosecuted, but also for Republicans, saying that he's had an easier time than he otherwise would have done because the administration is run by his father.
Tom Bateman. The president of the Maldives, Mohamed Mouizou, has announced that Israelis will be banned from entering the country as public anger has increased over the war in Gaza. Nearly 11,000 Israelis visited the luxury tourist destination in the Indian Ocean last year. Israel's foreign ministry has issued guidance recommending that Israeli citizens living in the Maldives consider leaving. Ali Wahid is a former Maldives tourism minister. So what's led to this decision?
More than 36,000 people have been killed, and there's no justification to these actions by Netanyahu and his government, and it has to be stopped. It has to be stopped immediately. We, as people of the Maldives, are siding with the principles and the just right thing to do. We are not blaming the citizens here, but I believe Maldives, even though we are a small nation, and while we depend on tourism, we at least got the guts and courage to do the right thing. Yes, it will have an impact on our industries, especially tourism, but the turbulence we will take, because people who want to visit our country are more towards doing the right thing. And I think the right thing is everyone to just say, stop it, we have had enough.
That was Ali Wahid. Now to an espionage row between London and Beijing. MI6, Britain's intelligence service, has been accused by China of recruiting a couple who worked for Beijing to spy for the UK. We got more details from our China correspondent, Laura Bicker.
These allegations were actually posted by the Ministry of State Security on their WeChat channel. Now, WeChat is the Chinese version of any social media app. So they've got their own channel, which they launched last August. And here they are putting details of allegations of spying. Now, the allegations centre around a Mr. Wang and his wife, Miss Jo. They say that he went to the UK in 2015 to study, and there MI6 operatives, they say, recruited him. They took him out for tours. They took him out for dinner to find his weaknesses. They said that he had a strong desire for money, according to this report, and that the MI6 operatives exploited this. In fact, they say that Mr. Wang was initially hesitant but could not resist persuasion, enticement, and even coercion. And they say that eventually Mr. Wang was given espionage training by MI6 and sent back to China to learn more about the Chinese government and pass that information to MI6 operatives. Now, we've had no word from the British government or from MI6 on this. And at the moment, this is just simply a statement reported by China from the Ministry of State Security. But this channel in recent months has also posted information to citizens asking them to be wary of foreign beauties, exotic beauties that may lure them into the hands of foreign spies. They've also asked citizens to be wary about what they're posting on their social media, for instance, pictures of airports, etc., that could be used by foreign spy agencies.
Now, what is it like growing up as the son of a Ku Klux Klan leader and then turning your back on that ideology? Well, Derek Black, who was born in 1989, describes that experience in a new book called The Klansman's Son, My Journey from White Nationalism to Anti-Racism. As a teenager, Derek ran the youth sections of his father's website, Stormfront, which calls itself the voice of a white minority. Among its readers was Anders Breivik, who killed 77 people in Norway in 2011. Derek Black has been speaking about the movement to Michel Hussein.
Violence from this movement was so common my entire life. It was something that we rationalized, my family rationalized, because they explicitly banned violent rhetoric on Stormfront, on my dad's website. People could be banned for that. And Breivik wasn't banned because he never said anything explicitly violent. He just said everything else about this ideology that I was growing up in. And that ideology named its enemies. It said who shouldn't be here, who
Muslims.
Didn't belong.
Breivik talked about Norway being flooded by Muslims.
All of his murders he justified with exactly the ideology that my family and I were advocating. And yet every time murders like this would happen, it would say, well, they condemned violence, so therefore this one psychopath is not their responsibility. And it was something that was so cold and so hard to rationalize that it did eat away at me in a way that I felt like I could just accept, well, my family is condemning this violence, and yet this movement, and getting close to a college community of people who I cared about, I knew, I loved. Many of them were not white, many of them were Jewish, and they felt afraid of what I represented. And if not specifically me, they felt afraid of the people in this movement who commit mass murders regularly, and the fact that I was connecting this campus to that world.
Publicly, your father, Don Black, has said about Stormfront that the number of killings that are associated with his website is as high as it is, which is close to 100, because of Breivik, that didn't have anything to do with politics. When you look back now, do you think that because you were a part of what Stormfront was putting out, that you have a responsibility over what Breivik did?
I certainly feel an enormous amount of guilt for everything that I wrote as a teenager, and especially in later years, because I advanced concepts like white genocide, which is exactly what motivated Breivik. This idea that just immigration and an intermarriage is genocide to people is something that white nationalists use to justify any action. They use to justify any amount of violence. The fact that I put things out that I could never take back is something that I'm committed, and I have been for the decades since I've condemned white nationalism, to advancing the cause against it. But no matter what I do, I can never take back any essay I wrote or any person who I persuaded to get involved in this movement. It's diffuse and I can't always trace it, but feeling that responsibility is something that I've never been able to rationalize or move past.
Derek Black. And the full interview is on the latest edition of the BBC programme Hard Talk. If you look up the term magnet fishing on the internet, which I had to do, here is the definition you'd find. Searching in outdoor waters for ferromagnetic objects available to pull up with a strong magnet. Recovered items may be dangerous, such as firearms, ammunition and bombs. You've been warned. But the items may also be rather valuable. Last week, James Kane and Barbie Agostini went magnet fishing at a lake in the New York district of Queens, and they pulled out a safe stuffed with around $100,000 in cash. They've been telling Andrew Peach about the experience.
All magnet fishers eventually get some safes, and I only felt different about this one when I saw the hole. I was trying to bang it on the floor to get the door open, so I saw the hole in the end of the other side of the safe, and I put it down back on the floor, and I saw something that looked like a long row of baggies. Sometimes when you find safes, you find little baggies. I guess that's where they stored coins or money or IDs or something like that. And I reached in with my hand, and in my brain, I'm like, oh no, this can't be happening.
And what was your reaction, Barbie, when it was not only a safe, which is quite an exciting find, but you could tell that it had got some money in it?
At first, I didn't believe it. I thought he was joking around or over-exaggerating. You know, because when we go out, we like to have some fun. Sometimes I'll joke on him, sometimes he'll joke on me. So I just thought he was just having some fun. So when he first told me, he's like, oh, it's money. I'm like, no way. No, it's not.
Were you able to just count it? Is it in good enough condition to just be able to think, how much have we got here? Or did you have to go through any kind of process to make the money safe and able to be used?
The money is actually so waterlogged, it is not usable at all. The NYPD couldn't even take it in as evidence. We did call into the police, because in New York City, when you find something like that, you have to let official know, or you could actually be in trouble if you take something like that. But it's very waterlogged. It's the size of money, but it's just almost like a mushy pancake. It's completely black, covered in mud. Well, you're able to separate and look inside, and you see the security strips. Clearly, it's all $100 bills, and it's very clear, you know?
So you've been allowed to keep it, but are you going to be able to take advantage of it? Is the money going to be usable? Are they going to reimburse you for the cash?
Not right away. In Washington, D.C., it's where they have our Bureau of Engraving and Printing, where they create the money, and it needs to be handed in by person or in mail, which I really don't trust mail, but we're going to hopefully bring it to them, and it could take up to 3 years, but they will rebuild every single bill forensically. They go through it, they'll clean it. It takes a long time, free of charge, but they will forensically find every serial number, even if it's in a shredder. The American money will be rebuilt, and they will cut us a check.
So one day, Barbie, you are going to be wealthy. Have you started spending it in your head yet?
Yes, I have. I keep thinking of little things here and there, different ideas I can spend it on. Wishful thinking.
It's a weird concept, isn't it, to think we know we're going to be rich, but we're going to wait 3 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, up to 3 years. It could be 6 months, you know what I mean? It could be a quick job. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm presuming this is the best thing you've found magnet fishing, but I better check.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest finds in history, actually, like with magnet fishers, cash value-wise. I mean, I know over there in England, some guys have found, you know, swords and all that. That's beautiful history, but this is just straight American cash value, which the history is awesome, but damn, money is pretty cool, too.
Of course it is, yes.
But I always wanted to search for treasure, and I thought you'd have to be wealthy with a ship and diving gear and tanks and all that. No, you can find treasure at your local pond.
James Kane and Barbie Agostini. And that's all from us for now. I'm off magnet fishing, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Nora Hull. The producer was Nikki Verrico, the editor Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.
The explanation from the BBC World Service.
What's actually going on here? Let's analyse it.
Making sense of the big stories.
As an economics reporter, what do you think the economic impact is?
Oh, it's massive.
And giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world.
We'll look at our subject from several different angles to connect dots with the geopolitics.
And explain the trends behind the fast-changing media landscape.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.